Warning. This story includes materials that are classified your ears only due to disturbing content. Other times we are quite silly and really just a hoot. Unless you were cleared for graphic depictions of sex, violence, or dirty words, this never happened. We were never here. It should go without saying that this is not intended for kids, but we're still saying it for their sake and for yours. We don't always play nice. You've been warned.
Sinister secret agents with shadowy employers and mysterious pasts. A bizarre landscape built from billions of minds. Arachnid-headed beings that guard a war-torn border zone. And all the worst that mankind has to offer, stalking the alleys and crumbling buildings of a place called Blue City. Is it a dream? Is it a nightmare? Or is it just a game? And are you already playing?
Actually, it's Lacuna Part 1, a tabletop role-playing game by Jared Sorensen. In 2010, a group of strangers who had never met in real life answered the call to participate in a text-based game called Lacuna, Slow Burn. None of us had any idea just how massive that story would become, or how much it would overtake our lives, let alone how far we were willing to go to keep that story alive. It's practically unkillable now. We are all very, very scared. Please help. I'm Don Fathom, a professional hypnotist and a writer. I help people think in new and interesting ways. Join me and my friends as we share an impossible story that will haunt your dreams, even as it toys with your sense of reality. Support this and my other projects at patreon.com/Don Fathom.
Lacuna Slow Burn starts now.
Furniture is overturned. Pictures are missing from the wall. Gems are pried from gaudy statues from various exotic locales. A large glass display case, devoid of whatever treasures it once held, hosts a neatly carved hole in the clear pane above the lock. All of this just in the hallway. This appears to be part of a large, lavishly and gaudily decorated manor. One that has been thoroughly ransacked. The hallway leads off to the left and the right, with the leftward path revealing a sharp right angle and three doors. To the right, the hallway opens to a large kitchen, and beyond that, doors that may lead to utility areas, maybe one to the outside. Barker stumbles into the hallway, more than a bit surprised at how easy that was. He retrieves the radio from the stairs and hefts it under his arm to secure a better grip, then quickly looks to the left and right.
Wonder where that noise went. Could be back. Kitchen. Something to wield.
He runs to his right and into the kitchen, laying down the radio on a counter and frantically looking for a knife or heavy object, opening the other doors in between searches. It dawns upon Barker that, while he's at his peak, this place might as well be built of rice paper and toothpicks. Radio in hand, Barker proceeds into the kitchen, bits of glass, wood, and other detritus crunching underfoot. The drawers are opened, cabinets ransacked, a place of broken dishes and scattered silverware. A smorgasbord of potentially dangerous implements are haphazardly spread throughout the room. A paring knife, a large serrated bread knife, a large meat cleaver, a small frying pan, a large frying pan, a large meat tenderizer, a serrated portable electric meat slicer, a blowtorch with an increased chance of explosion or collateral damage. As Barker mulls over his selection of weapons, he has a sudden urge to go back down into the basement and carve another hash mark into the concrete floor with the remains of the penknife. The urge diminishes, but does not completely fade. The kitchen has two doors, the open doorway that leads back to the hallway, and the swinging door that most likely leads to a dining room. There's another slamming sound, a door. Maybe the front door. Barker grabs the electric knife and whirls to the direction of the sound. He's so distracted by the chaos and his panic state that he forgot to turn the radio off and has tuned its static out.
Good. Time to stop running. Okay, think. If this place has been ransacked by thieves, maybe they're not involved with me being in that basement. If so, they're likely finishing up their looting, which means that could be an exit. And if I am involved, maybe they simply tried to block me away so they could steal everything. Either way, I get out, and they're not stopping me. He grabs the radio again and grips the knife tightly, making sure to have a strong grip on it despite his sweaty hands, hovering his thumb over the power switch or button or whatever, then dashes towards the slam door with, finally, a purpose and a plan. A squeeze of the electric meat slicer's trigger will unleash the fury of its serrated parallel blades. The radio, the size and heft of a typical hardcover book, fits easily under one arm or beneath Barker's suit jacket. As Barker breaks into a short run, dashing across an empty and ransacked dining room, the urge to mar the basement floor returns. Now he imagines not one, but two perfect hash marks on that cold concrete floor. Two more. But what in God's name was he counting? Barker slides into the foyer, now facing the front door. It is slowly sliding back open, the lock violently torn asunder with a crowbar and thus unable to fully seal this particular portal of egress. In the driveway, a rusty box truck looks to have just pulled out, quickly cruising out of view. Barker glances over his shoulder in the direction of the basement, then back to the departing truck. Ten? Ten what? Don't forget ten.
He fits the radio into his inner jacket pocket next to the document and gazes after the truck.
I've got to know more. This is no good. Even if they can't help me, at least I have a ride. Ten, ten, ten.
He shrugs his shoulders and adjusts his jacket.
Go!
Then breaks into a sprint.
The Heights. A series of towering mansions on ample, verdant estates enclosed behind a large privacy wall. Sparse bird song is the only sound present as one approaches. A wrought iron gate protects the community. Just beyond the gate, a security booth lies empty with no guard in sight. Chaffer ogles the stately mansions that loom on either side of him as he walks. He finds that his pace slows a bit, for this area of the city seems far more pleasant than its downtrodden predecessor. He finds, too, that his spirit is lifted by the change of scenery. He looks at Turner and says, "Shall we see if we can apprehend this handsome grocer and see what he has to say? Or would you like to stalk that rogue agent that the woman referred to?" A tired, disheveled fellow in a tan trench coat and a green tie slowly approaches from behind the gate. He takes a few steps over to the guard shack, reaches in, and works an iron lever with a leather grip at the top. The gate shutters before sliding out of the way, old rusted gears screeching as they are forced into action. The gentleman in the green tie looks from one side to the other before addressing Chaffer. "You here for Voyer?" he asks. "I sure hope so. The escalations are getting worse in there. Your friend is in danger." Turner's eyes scan the area carefully. Despite its much more pleasant appearance, one still should always be wary of their surroundings. At Chaffer's question, she thinks carefully before replying. "The grocer might be nothing, but if he appeared when this rogue agent did, then maybe we should..." She pauses behind him as the gates begin to open, tilting her head slightly as the man addresses Chaffer. "Who's in danger? What's going on?" she asks, wondering if the man speaking looks familiar or not. Although his face looks the same, there's no sign of recognition in the man's bloodshot eyes. Turner appears to be a stranger to him. "Unknown mystery agent. I recognized him from the suit. Last seen heading down that road." He points ahead a few blocks into the right, with what appeared to be a cordless electric kitchen knife. Subject was in pursuit of a red box truck circa 1920. "The problem is, I did not see a proper badge on him." The green tie gestures to the pin marked with a question mark on each agent's lapel. If he meets the hostile personality without it, there won't be much he can do. Depending on the nature of the HP, your friend may be in grave danger. Tucker arrives, having kept his pace quick but not feeling tired at all. He quickly assesses the situation. Rather than approach his teammates, he hangs back just inside earshot and waits to discover the situation before making himself obvious. "I think we'd better get the lad out and apprehend this HP sooner than not. What do you think?" Chaffer eyeballs the stranger and then turns to Agent Turner. When he sees Agent Tucker, he beckons him forward. "I completely agree," Turner says with a nod as she gives the green tie another careful look over. Her hand raises as if she were going to point at him until she notices Chaffer's attention turning towards Tucker. A slight grin raises the corner of her lips, though nothing is said yet at the moment. "Assess the situation?" she asks Tucker, while crossing her arms tightly under her chest. Tucker smiles thinly. "You could say that. Do we have any other leads?" Chaffer says, "We're after a bloke who's possibly masquerading as an agent. Last seen in hot pursuit of a vintage red truck." Chaffer points in the direction that green tie indicated. "Perhaps we should commandeer a vehicle."
The agent's feet rapidly switch places as he hauls off after the truck. Within three blocks, he's caught up with the vehicle. The man behind the wheel glances over casually, his window down, a mess of brown hair tossed about by the wind. The look of mischief is easily read on his face.
"What are you doing out of the basement?" he yells over the rush of air. "He knew I was in there. Did he put me in the basement? Well, now what? Gotta get on this thing somehow."
Barker looks at the man quizzically, wondering what to do next and how to respond. He tries to find something to grab onto so he doesn't have to keep running, preferably away from the window, near the back if need be, in case the driver attacks. The unwieldy vehicle can barely push 30 miles an hour. Even at this rate of speed, Barker must maintain an inhuman running pace. 11, he suddenly thinks, to keep up. There's a thin rear bumper he could grab if he slowed down a bit and swerved to snag it. Otherwise, there's a good chance he may be sideswiped depending on the subject at hand's character. Barker twists and spaces his strides to build some momentum, then springs himself to the top of the truck to access the door on the other side, running alongside the driver's door, and get himself in the truck, readying his knife in case it gets hostile. The man's eyes light up like a kid watching fireworks as Barker deftly navigates the vehicle's exterior. He's laughing so hard he's bent in the middle. "Buckle up," he says, trying to catch his breath. There's another bout of laughter as Barker realizes there's no seatbelts. "I've heard of running with scissors, but..." He gestures to the cordless electric knife. "What is this? Am I being robbed with... There's more snickering. Barker withholds an urge to slug the driver across the jaw, but not only realizes how silly that'd be, considering he's driving, but that he wants to get information out of him if he can.
"Stow the funny! Who are you? And what'd you leave me in that basement for? And the manor, it's a mess! What's going on here anyway?"
He seems a bit disappointed that his knife isn't very threatening, but keeps himself ready anyway.
"Right, stowing the funny," the man says, faux serious.
His eyes wander over Barker.
"Cut yourself there?"
Barker realizes that beneath the rush of his rapidly beating heart, there's a stinging sensation. Blood soaks his pant leg and laces the blade of the electric knife.
"Maybe we should get you to a hospital. If the tumble didn't do enough damage, that automated cutlery tried to finish you off. The name's Dick, by the way."
Barker looks down at his leg and pats at it gently, looking for the source of the blood. He panics and quickly looks around for a cloth or garment, something to wrap around the wound and mitigate the blood flow. Failing to find anything, he just uses his jacket.
"Is there any first aid in this blasted thing?" says Barker, checking any storage compartments around. "You still didn't answer my question, Dick. What's with that basement?" "Nah, I didn't see any first aid kits when I was robbing the place," Dick says, surveying the boxy interior of the vehicle.
He takes his eyes off the road for a moment to give Barker a hard stare.
"I didn't put you in that basement. I let you finish your nap. Weren't you curious as to why they have a door like that?"
His head snaps forward again.
"So where are we headed? I don't know this place very well."
"I'm curious about everything," says Barker, frantically tying his leg off with whatever he can find.
"How did you know I was down there with the door closed? Did you check and just leave me?"
he says with a certain panicked and annoyed tone.
Dick nods approvingly. "I saw the lock on the door. Thought there might be something good down there. When I saw you at the bottom of the stairs, I checked for a pulse and used my pen flashlight to see how bad off you were. I figured you'd survive. If other cops, or agents, whatever, were on the way, then I had to get moving. I swear I was going to call it in anonymously when I was far enough away, he explains calmly. I even jammed the lock in case the owners came back first. I had no idea what they were planning. You should have seen their bedroom. His eyes glaze for a moment before he comes to. But now you're here. So where's the nearest hospital? Barker blinks hard and looks around the neighborhood, trying to gather his wits in the middle of his racing mind. I don't recognize any of this. Barker wipes some sweat from his brow and closes his eyes, trying to rack his brain to think of maybe even a safe house or meeting location. Well, I sure as shit don't want you bleeding to death, my man. Let's see how fast this baby goes. The vehicle accelerates slightly, pushing 35 miles per hour, or 56 kilometers, before the frame begins to visibly shake around them. Well, that's disappointing. Although the roads are empty, the man involuntarily winces as he speeds through an empty intersection.
A very old-looking red box truck, a 1909 Hemmings Walker, cruises by at a frame-rattling 35 miles per hour. From the passenger side, a man in a black suit looks over at the agents. A moment later, the driver glances over as well, eyes going wide as he spies the group mulling about the main entrance. I suppose this is where the Jelly Roll Morton music begins and we chase after the truck, says Chaffer, smiling. What now? Turner's mouth opens just slightly as the truck passes, the effect just added with Chaffer's comment. You know, Agent Chaffer, I haven't the foggiest idea. We have leads in what looks like an agent taking a ride in something that looks like Mr. Rogers' train car. Tucker, she finishes, giving the choice to him. Tucker's momentarily dumbfounded by the sight of the vehicle and its occupants, and then springs into action. We grab a car and follow that trolley. He looks around for a parked car he could take, but if necessary, he'd carjack a civilian. He calls over his shoulder, and I was thinking Yakety Sax myself. On this street, there's a silver ghost, Barker Tour body style, circa 1909, parked in front of a stately Victorian mansion, lorded over by two intimidatingly ugly gargoyle statues. Tucker runs over to the parked ghost, hops in, and tries to start it. Good thing it was fairly simple technology, relatively speaking. Perhaps Agent Tucker has vague memories of hot-wiring cars in his younger years, or at least a basic knowledge of electronics. Of any of these possibilities, the starter's configuration within this particular vehicle looks downright alien. After crossing seemingly random wires, Tucker can't seem to get the vehicle started. The agent in the green tie takes a few steps back. He is looking at everything with suspicion, as if something's going to jump out at any moment. Agent Tucker, are you escalating? He asks, trying to look everywhere at once. A curtain parts on the top floor of the creepy Victorian domicile. The curtain relaxes again, and some 20 seconds pass before the door comes open. It's a balding man, somewhere in his 50s, wearing a thick blue bathrobe, slippers, and a sheen of moisture, likely bathwater or sweat. Young man, he yells as he approaches the vehicle. One hand darts into a pocket on the side of his robe as he stares hard at Tucker. Tucker hops out of the ghost and curses. Seeing no better choice, he begins chasing after the truck. Sure, it's moving faster than what he recalled as the maximum human foot speed, but he could make it, he knew, somehow. Agent Tucker bolts out of the car, easily dodging the old man in the blue bathrobe. In a surreal, almost cartoonish manner, Tucker gains speed from a jog to an inhuman procession of paces, building not unlike a locomotive. For him, everything blurs as he catches sight of the red truck a street down.
Out of the corner of his eye, Barker catches a group of figures wearing familiar black suits and sunglasses, passively watching them from a few blocks to the left. Dick takes notice too. You've brought friends! Now I've gotten to find another way out of here. This does not bode well for our relationship. Barker blinks and whirls around to try and hopefully look out a window in the back of the truck as they cruise past, squinting to try and see them more clearly through his blurred and rattled vision. They're with me. At least, they wear what I do. Dick apparently doesn't like them, but for some reasons has a rapport with me. Am I against them? Am I with Dick? Am I undercover? They could help me, get my leg some attention. Should I play along? If I caught this truck, they can too.
Barker takes a long look at Dick, trying to think fast.
I gotta figure out if avoiding these guys is possible. Might be best to play safe and conservative for now.
You got us here. You didn't check for good escape routes?
I should have. No, wait. I would have, says the man, sweat beading on his brow.
That's weird.
He points to the street sign at the next crossroads. Instead of letters, the signs present meaningless gibberish.
You can't even read the signs here. What is this? Where the hell are we? I don't even know the name of this city. I've usually got it more together than this. Ever since I was...
And suddenly there's a sharp intake of breath.
I've got things in the back of this truck. Things you wouldn't believe. He licks his lips. No way I'd half-ass a job like this. I'm thinking.
He yanks the wheel to one side.
Left here.
The vehicle tilts slightly as it banks the curve, almost tipping. They clumsily round a corner. Neat lawns, high rooftops, and exquisite stone edifices greet them wherever they go in this eclectic collection of estates. The entire neighborhood is dense with posh, expensive houses, all extravagant masonry tucked behind initial bearing front gates, though attempts to read any such initials fail.
Two blocks south from here, we take a right and we'll hit a circle that takes us around to the rear of the clubhouse. There's a service entrance back there. I'm not sure how I know that. Breathe, Dick. This clunker isn't too solid,
noting the rattling and the sharp curve.
Okay, so a clubhouse, great. Do you have any idea what's waiting for us there? If these guys follow us, we could be boxed in.
Barker glances at his leg, checking to see if it's gotten any worse.
It's the only plan I've got. You think we're already surrounded?
Dick mops a sleeve across his forehead.
Why do I keep thinking about centipedes?
Barker instinctively remembers that pain typically follows shock. So why is this loose flap of leg meat barely stinging? Aside from a general reduction in constitution, Barker does not seem to be getting any worse. The bleeding has stopped, though there's no sign of scabbing or healing. Exposed meat and fat glisten from within the open wound. Barker is momentarily, simultaneously fascinated and perplexed at his leg, trying to take in and figure it all out, gently patting the wound. After a moment, he shakes it off and accepts it, recognizing there's bigger stakes at hand right now. He'll get back to this mystery later.
Forget the bugs. Focus on the route and be careful with this clunker. We can figure it out when we're not rushed.
Barker leans out his window to check behind him and see if the others are in pursuit. One of the agents rounds the corner determinedly, only a street behind and perpendicular to them. In seconds, he'll overtake the slow, clumsy box truck.
There's one behind us, Dick!
Barker shouts, whirling his head back into the truck.
I'm not sure here. I guess I'll wait and see.
Barker shoots a glance at Dick to gauge his reaction.
What's his deal with these suits, and furthermore, why does he trust me?
You guys need anything else? The older gentleman seems to come out of a brief trance as Green Tie addresses the group of agents. Shambling towards them, he withdraws a pair of scissors from that pocket he's been fumbling in. A smile crosses his face from ear to ear. Fuck no, old man, says the Green Tie. Defensively, his hands go up. I don't want to see what comes next, he says, as he slowly backs his way towards the open gate. Don't run, they'll only get crazier, he says, even as he backpedals a little more quickly. Agent Chaffer bolts after the red truck, yelling, Bloody hell! And feels winded almost immediately. The Green Tie calls out, I said don't run! Turner makes to run as well, but the confusion of the situation has her planting her feet at the shouts from the fellow with the Green Tie. Holding up her hands as well and taking several steps back from the scissor-handling citizen, she mutters a calm, Let's just all drop the crazy, okay? Those bangs, exclaims the old man, snipping at the air. You know, I was a barber for 20 years. It's been the family business for three generations. Surely a free touch-up from a consummate professional would be welcome, he explains, exasperated by their reactions. Now he points to Green Tie. And you, sir, have you even had a proper trim this month? I have half a mind to fetch my razor and strop for the likes of you. Screeching tires can be heard in the distance. From Chaffer's position, his ears catch two faint voices yelling at each other as the vehicle careens out of control. Chaffer musters his energy and attempts one more sprint towards the vector of the sound. "Who the bloody hell do I think I am? Roger Bannister?" he says, towing the line. He sprints about 5 feet and feels a searing pain in his Achilles tendon and stops. Bugger all. There's no permanent damage to Chaffer. The pain and difficulty last only a moment, though his senses had told him a different story. He limps toward the noise, muttering and cursing to himself, and then steels himself again and tries to run. Despite the agony that he feels, Chaffer is able to muster the intestinal fortitude to try for a dash at top speed and reach his destination. No discomfort came from a light jog, but anything more proves too difficult. The CME agent and his green tie have disappeared. The old man visibly despairs. As if in sympathy, the sky above the heights grows darker. With reluctance, he pockets his scissors. "I miss cutting hair," he says, woefully addressing Turner. "I meant you no harm. A strange feeling overtook me. There are so few visitors here, you know. To work a proper barbershop beyond these walls would render me a laughingstock before my peers. Other doors are opening. People are stepping out from there in various states of dress, their shoulders slumped, bewildered looks on their faces. All of them look to Turner.
Tucker propels himself forward at inhuman speeds and catches up with the truck. He overtakes it and tries to force entry through the rear passenger side door. He prepares to defend himself if need be when he notices the man in the black suit is missing his lapel. "Agent, what the fuck is going on in here?" Tucker easily hoists himself into the vehicle, needing to crouch or rest on one knee to fit into the rear of the cab. The driver glances back at Tucker nervously before returning his attention to the road. "And now one's here. Take care of it," says the driver as he banks another corner with little regard for physics. Again, the vehicle nearly tips, and the high walls of the truck threaten to buckle, audibly creaking as the frame shifts. Ahead is the clubhouse, a quaint, yellow, almost plastic-looking building, overlooking a stately golf course that, from all other sides, has been blocked by trees, houses, and their privacy walls. Ahead is a dirt turnoff just beyond a long row of sycamore trees, tire tracks cutting through grass, leading through a small gap in the wall surrounding the heights. Barker is thrown to the side of the truck as Dick swerves, having started his way back there to try and think of something. "This is going to be awkward." Barker struggles to recover his balance, trying his best to put on a show for Dick while getting through to Tucker. "Who are you?" he spits at Tucker, making a confused face at him and shrugging a bit. "Agent Tucker," he said. "Are you Agent Barker or the other one?" "I'm Barker," he replies, unsure what to do next. "Who's the other one?" The driver looks back a second time, momentarily locking eyes with Tucker. It's like he can see right through those shades. In turn, Tucker gets a good look at the driver, a lean, muscular man nearing his 30s, brown hair mopped with sweat, grass and mud stains dotting the collar of his white shirt. Although much of his face is clear of marring, near flawless, a tiny red divot on either side of his nose could be the only spots where glasses would momentarily rest. Barker notices the look between the two, and while looking Tucker over, notices the emblem on his lapel. He pads at his own ripped version, looking back at Tucker. "Dick!" he whirls around. "Why was my jacket ripped? There's more to this than I know," looking back expectantly at Tucker for answers. "Control mentioned there were 6 on the slab, and that your vitals were out of sync. The team is 4, so you had to be Barker or the other one. Dick. Richard. Late 20s. Wears glasses. Short brown hair. Clean cut. Got you, you son of a bitch." Tucker takes his device off of his lapel. "I'm guessing if your jacket was..." He suddenly lunged for the driver, intent on activating the device. Eyes wide with primal recognition, Dick screams out, "What is that? Don't touch me with that thing!" The man wrenches the wheel hard as he tries to maneuver out of Tucker's way, imperiling both agents. If nobody takes control of the vehicle will most likely tip and slam into a nearby house or tree. "Barker, steer!"
as he wrapped one abnormally strong arm around Dick in the back seat, trying to render the man immobile with his arms bound to his sides so that he could place and activate the device. Tucker wrestles with the man but fails to maintain a good grip. Dick squirms, kicks, and curses as he shifts about in his seat. There's a brief ripping sound from his midsection. He groans. Something long and sharp has gouged Tucker's wrist. The button clatters to the floor.
"What'd you do?"
Dick asks, his words slurring. A rivulet of blood blossoms beneath his white shirt as if he's been stabbed. The sinews in his neck tighten. Involuntary muscle action pulls his head back as his spine arches awkwardly. Barker springs into action. That was all he needed. He lunges back into the cab and hurls himself to the wheel, taking a deep breath and hunkering down amidst the chaos and panic, forcing himself to endure through it. Tucker feels the gouge as he drops the button. He keeps holding onto the target as he reaches for the button, taking care not to look at his wrist. Some strange instinct tells him that as long as he doesn't look at it, the wound's not real. Spurred on by his initial failure, he grabs the pin off the ground and throws everything he had into pinning the target and holding him still long enough to count to three. In one brutal, overpowering motion, his arms swing from the ground to on top of Dick's chest, his hand hovering above Dick's neck before slamming the pin into it and twisting clockwise. He counts to three, and then wishes that the device's preparation, application, and activation, as he'd executed them, sends the target to the lacuna. Now there's nothing for him to do but wait for what happens next. Convulsing. Dick hardly seems to notice Tucker reasserting himself. As Tucker slams down the pin and counts, the hostile personality is revealed. Flesh rips and sloughs off like wet paper. Clothing and skin stretching and splitting as 23 pointy-ended yellow insectile legs unfold from each side. The body almost pours from below him, a long, snaking invertebrate form, bending and folding awkwardly within the confines of the truck's cab. A pair of rending mandibles tear out of the man's cheeks. The eyes flatten and burst, silvery black compact lenses peeking out from the neat round holes in his papier-mâché flesh. A large section of cold, wet exoskeleton slumps against Barker's leg. The agent manages to right the unwieldy vehicle despite his gag-inducing case of the creepy crawlies.
"You deserved it,"
says the creature, its voice grating like sandpaper. And it's gone. Tucker finds himself kneeling in a mess of blood, split skin, and various slick, tattered membranes. Barker falls towards the driver's seat as Dick disappears, struggling to keep the truck steady. He shifts himself to the seat and takes control of the vehicle, straightening it out and bringing it to a slow, then a stop. He shifts it to park and just sits there.
"What the hell was that?"
Barker exclaims, turning around to look at Tucker, hopefully expecting answers. Tucker does his best to wipe some of the gore off. "The mission. That was the mission. Turn this thing around and let's tell the team we can go home. Maybe the debrief will make sense." Barker sighs, his heart pounding. He turns to the windshield again and wipes his face of sweat and any splattered gore, then starts driving towards Chaffer and Turner.
"This is all too messed up.
I guess that was him. Voyeur, right?
Ugh. I don't remember anything. It's all hazy,"
Barker says, groaning slightly. "How long have I been out? Wait, we weren't together." Tucker recalls the mission and gives Barker a brief summary of what happened.
"Right. Richard Voyeur. We don't remember much either. None of us remembers you. You must have been inserted separately."
"Separately," says Barker, pondering briefly.
"Why?
And more importantly, how?"
"I guess we'll find out more soon."
Limping, Chaffer waves as he sees the truck heading towards him. A look of perplexity wrinkles his long face. He pauses and waits for the truck to slow down. Barker slows the truck and leans out the window, noting Chaffer's suit and appearance. He waves him towards the truck briefly.
Agent, he calls, nodding at Chaffer. Good to see you. Hop in. We'll pick up the others.
I'm Agent Barker.
You're Turner or Chaffer?
You two all right?
A bit worse for wear, but holding up.
Chaffer extends an etiolated hand to Barker.
My name is Chaffer.
He smiles thinly and drags a hand through sweat-soaked hair.
Turner is back a ways, he says, removing his jacket and rolling up his sleeves. I need to work on my sprints, I'm afraid.
He peers at the truck to see if there's room and plants a cigarette between his bloodless lips and lights it. The sky darkens. Tucker grins at Chaffer, still covered in God knows what. Mission accomplished. We got him. With Agent Chaffer aboard, the truck speeds up again and rolls back to the heights to meet up with Turner. The streets have shifted subtly behind their backs, intersecting and turning in all the wrong directions, a configuration unlike anything the agents may remember from mere seconds ago. The street signs remain illegible as ever. The homes at the back end of the heights are actually quite close to the manor. Agent Barker still recognizes the style of privacy wall surrounding that particular property. One needs only cross the greens, a large golf course threading through the center of the community. The service entrance is still available should the agents wish to escape back onto the streets. Agent Tucker looks out the window, trying to locate a phone. Turner and Coleman should be able to eject on their own, as long as they knew the mission is complete. Tucker sighs. He just can't catch a break today, other than the whole HP zooming past them thing. Okay, one more try. Then we're bugging out, and you find your own way home. Turn here, he directs Barker, as he tries to find the most direct path back to the heights. Hopefully it would go well, because otherwise Turner and Coleman were on their own. Chaffer sidles into the cab, grimacing as he sees what's left of the HP. As he sees the city streets begin to waver and fold over themselves, he says, I think it's time for us to leave the Blue City for a spell. Don't you agree?
I'm dying to get out and shower, Tucker says. But first, we should let Turner and Coleman know the job is done, and it's time to get out. Seeing as how we're not in any immediate danger, I could probably eject with a pair of scissors sticking out of my chest. I don't see the harm in letting them know. They'll probably figure out it's time to go eventually, but just in case. Phones can be heard ringing inside every house in the Heights.
If things weren't surreal enough, Turner can now hear all of the phones within the surrounding houses ringing, as well as the one in the empty guard's booth. The old truck comes clunking through the streets towards Agent Turner. Tucker shouts from the side, Mission accomplished, eject now. Barker says, wait, eject? Like leave? Leave this? Looking up at the darkened sky as he finishes his sentence, somehow grasping an idea of what he means. What bothers him more, though, is why he's having trouble with all this, but that's for another time. He notices all the phones ringing and the people emerging. He slows the vehicle down and gazes, beginning to look a bit worried. What's going on? We should get Turner, right? We don't need to get anyone. Once she knows the mission is complete, she can eject herself. Now get out of here. I'll handle the rest and make sure the team gets out, Tucker says, positioning himself to take the wheel when Barker ejects. How? Looking at Tucker expectantly. He glances away briefly, then closes his eyes. I have no idea what I'm doing. Damn it, Barker. Just remember your training and keep on trying, Tucker explains. Worst case scenario, I'll eject you myself, but I want to make sure nobody else needs my help first. The agents hurtle clumsily towards the front gate. Dozens of people exit their homes, vying to flag down the truck. They yell at the personal, private details of their lives, hoping that someone will hear them. At full speed, the agents in the truck can only catch snippets of wild and lurid things. Are people really so passive-aggressive, perverted, and self-serving at their core? Turner is still facing the scissor-happy older man in the blue bathrobe. His neighbors shamble up behind him, voices drowning out whatever heartfelt confession he had with their own disclosures. Soon Turner is surrounded by the candidly outspoken masses. A girl of six in pigtails and a dress festooned with little daffodils cups her hands to her mouth, shouting, I wish Graham would just die already. Barker panics from the full-on dosage of unsettling and disturbing events unfolding. He shakes himself, trying to keep his head about him. That's enough, Agent. Gather your wits. Now. He curses and refocuses his efforts on the road, trying to keep the clunker rolling, together, and avoiding the growing throngs of people. He looks briefly out the window to see if Turner made it out. Chaffer closes his eyes and says, smiling, I'll see all of you on the other side. Chaffer attempts to eject again, and much to his chagrin, finds that his attempt is abortive. Barker tries to get a grip on himself and eject one more time. Finding herself soon to be alone, faced with something out of the crazies, Turner continues to back up. Don't run! She remembered that pretty well. But what was making these people act this way? She wasn't prepared to be confronted by this, and perhaps panic was altering her state of mind. She keeps taking steps back, but was now glancing around her to see if there was anything there to defend herself with. The crowd's collective mood changes. As Turner searches for a potential weapon, the plaintive cries become screaming, angry voices. Damn it, Turner, what are you doing? Tucker shouts from the window as the truck closes the distance between the two of them. Slow it down, he directs Barker as he hops out and reaches for Turner, hoping to eject her. The people surge, surrounding Turner, Tucker, and the box truck. Hands smear the truck's windows as the angry crowd tilts it from side to side, shaking the agents within. Turner didn't know what had come over her. Perhaps it was the failed leap earlier that had her head screwed on backwards. When the crowd begins to swarm, she closes her eyes tightly and just prays. A moment later, she felt someone pull her right before hearing being yelled at, which were just words without meaning for the most part given the situation. When her fellow agent makes physical contact, Turner finally feels the pull of the outside world. It's like waking from a dream. Tucker turns his attentions next to Barker, who can't seem to eject on his own. He puts one hand on Barker, and he too, in turn, is ejected.
Emergency ejection procedure initiated.
Tucker's field of vision narrows as he nears cardiac arrest. As his surroundings pitch blue, then red, he fades back to the waiting room. With his fellow agents already ejected, Chaffer becomes the primary focus of the angry mob. The truck slams on one side. Fists slam it on every exposed side, though none makes an effort to open the door and actually enter the cab. Bloody hell! Chaffer begins to cower as the mob swells around the vehicle. Chaffer takes another stab at ejecting from the Blue City, and fortunately for him, he feels a slight omission.
The waiting room is empty. Does it even exist when unoccupied? One imagines a lonely place, just empty chairs and the hum of the overhead lights in the moments before the first returning agent appears.
Tucker comes hurtling back to consciousness as if waking up from a nightmare. It's very much like waking up, in fact, right down to that extreme warmth and desire not to leave the covers. Except after a moment, Tucker realizes that the heat is coming from inside. His heart is still racing. Chaffer is his first word and his first thought. Where's Chaffer?
Right beside you, mate, says Chaffer, his Cockney accent revealing more and more East End in his family tree. The first thing the thin, dour man does is light a cigarette and inhale deeply. That was quite a fiasco, wasn't it? A plume of smoke mushrooms through his bloodless lips and spirals upward. Chaffer watches the ceiling fan eviscerate the smoke. Thanks for taking the reins. We couldn't have got through without you.
Tucker breathes a sigh of relief. Holy shit, I'm glad you made it. Sorry I left you behind. I thought I had just enough left in me to pop you out. But the auto-eject disagreed. I was just doing my job to the best of my abilities, same as the rest of you. What about Coleman? I lost track of him.
Neither hide nor hair, says Chaffer. Coleman just seemed to up and vanish.
Tucker sighs. Hopefully he found his way back. Say, do you think Control's monitoring us here?
Barker jolts awake with a start, and then freezes, darting his eyes around the room anxiously. When he finally realizes where he is after a few moments, he heaves a sigh of relief and relaxes. Then he gasps and springs up again, patting at his leg to see if it's all right. A flap of skin and loose meat, the shade of raw pork, some 2 inches thick, flaps about bloodlessly on the edge of Barker's outer thigh. Although the clothing and flesh is torn, there is no physical discomfort.
Assume that Control is always watching, says Chaffer anemically. His lethargy is short-lived, however, for Barker's sudden movement catches him off guard and sends a cigarette twirling into his lap, Saw it off, he says, sweeping hot ash from his crotch and cramming the bent cigarette back into his mouth. What the hell happened to your leg, Barker? Turner wakes up staring at the ceiling of the waiting room. It takes her brain a moment to process, but when it does, she holds back a frustrated sigh. The voices around her ensure at first that all seems well, so she just lays there and covers her face partly with her arm. Panicking on your first mission wasn't good. She should have known better than that. It wasn't until mention of Barker's injury that she actually sits up to look around. Her eyes catch sight of the fleshy mess and her lip curls slightly. What the hell happened? Faint, muffled voices can be heard through the white walls of the waiting room.
Put paddles down. All this equipment can't...
We're going to lose him if we... Adrenaline. I said adrenaline.
Tucker sighs again. Shit. I think they're talking about me. You don't think I'm going to die, am I? I mean, that's the whole point of the emergency ejection. They wouldn't let me go past the point of no return and then eject me. That'd be pointless.
Barker just kind of stares at his leg, then pokes it cautiously. That's just weird. He eventually takes his attention elsewhere, listening to the faint voices. It sounds like you're going to be okay. It's just as much your job as it is theirs, though. Focus, Agent Tucker. Don't let go.
Two voices can be heard.
See? BPM is dropping naturally as he comes out of Theta. Christ, are you going to flatline this guy to prove a point? What are we doing about Coleman? We ejected him about an hour ago. Hopefully he'll just come out of it. And the subject?
A third voice intercedes.
I don't mean to interrupt, but we've got reduced eye catalepsy. They can probably hear us. They won't remember anyway. Wake them up. Of course, Senior Instructor Snyder. That's Agent Son, don't forget it.
Bright light fills the cold room consisting of a series of flat, raised beds and blinking lights. The agents wake to find themselves nigh paralyzed. Vision and hearing are distorted at best. Busy technicians worry over the agents. A stern gentleman in his autumn years greets them. Congratulations, agents. Mission accomplished. When you've recovered, I'll expect you for debriefing. From here, the agents have fuzzy memories of small talk, donuts, and coffee. Agent Tucker finds that his shirt has been ripped open, a clear gel smeared on his chest. The blurry box next to him with its flat, glistening metal paddles could only be a defibrillator. It comes as no small relief that it remains unused.
End mission abusive.
Greetings, junior agents. When you observe yourself from a different perspective, you notice something interesting. All it takes is a little gap, some kind of interruption between who you are and who you used to be. A span of time, a change in lifestyle, the reinterpreting of a memory, and suddenly the person you were hits different now. Like how an arm or a leg feels when it goes to sleep without you. Or being startled by something you knocked over, surprised by your own shadow, being creeped out by that reflection you took your eyes off for just a moment. The way a beloved childhood toy feels in your adult hands. Old pictures and recordings. Feelings you remember having at some point in your life, however different you might feel now. The stories that other people tell about us. And I think that is something you gain when you become a mystery agent. Even a crisp suit and a pair of sunglasses can change how you perceive yourself and how you interact with others. None of us ever really did this cloak and dagger stuff, except Text Omitted, who is obviously an actual mystery agent thinly disguised as a surrealist poet. For the rest of us, all you can really do is put on your suit and tie and sunglasses and lacuna device and do your best impression of some book or TV show's best impression of something that never really existed. Because we interpret ourselves differently depending on the circumstances. And the message we send is a reflection of those circumstances. For example, this message from our sponsor. Reflect on what it means to you.
Hello, friends. This is Matt Kimmel, otherwise known as Agent Tucker. Do you know I also make tabletop RPG stuff? You can check it out at orpheuspress.itch.io. You'll find some solo journaling games and the best 5th edition adventure I ever wrote. It takes place in an out-of-control, rolling wizard's tower. It's a great gimmick and you should check it out. That's orpheuspress.itch.io, or you can find us at DriveThruRPG.
So, where was I? Oh yes, how it feels to be a new you. A different you. As you start to notice exactly what it is that's changed, and how. It's good to have an outlet and a safe place to explore the edges of our own personalities. We get to experience a different side of ourselves, even a few old hidden ones. It's interesting to see the first steps of what each agent becomes, even to imagine what would have been for the agents who didn't last long enough for us to find out. I enjoy each and every one of their stories. I'm glad to have been a part of them, whatever time we had to be ourselves in such a strange and interesting context. I'm not in the middle of this story anymore. It looks different from the outside. More flawed and yet more beautiful than I remember. Sometimes we forget that in our fantasies, we too are fictional characters. I'm Don Fathom, a writer and a professional hypnotist. I help people understand the role they play in their own lives, so you can start playing the game the way you want to. Thank you for listening. We know you did it, and now you're going to pay. I mean, if you want more content like this, just join our Patreon and support this and other projects so we can continue to expand our influence over the unsuspecting masses. You'll get access to all my classified materials and a bunch of stuff I made up. Because, let's be honest, they're all the same thing, really. Discover things the public just isn't ready to know. Experience the thrill of fictionally endangering yourself on a daily basis. Remain in a state of constant paranoia. Get bonuses, exclusive materials, early releases, and live broadcasts, all this and more, at patreon.com/DonFathom. That's DonFathom. We're on social stuff, too. Check it all out. We're Midnight Police on YouTube, TikTok, X, and Facebook. On Instagram, we are The Midnight Police. That is The Midnight Police. Get it right. You've been warned. This week's episode was written by Don Fathom, Matt Kimmel, Ian Bloom, and entities working under the pseudonyms Agent Chaffer, a.k.a. Older Cloud, and Agent Turner. This episode was read by Don Fathom, Matt Kimmel, and Ian Bloom. Production, editing, music, sound effects, and pretty much everything else was by me, Don Fathom.
All content from Lacuna Part 1, Second Attempt, is copyrighted by Memento Mori Theatrics. All rights reserved and whatnot. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 license. Quick review, agents. That means you can copy and distribute Lacuna Slow Burn as long as you give us appropriate credit and do not change it or use it for commercial purposes. If you do, we'll sick the Spider-Man on you. Or something even worse, lawyers.
That concludes this episode, Junior Agents. But we're not done here. We are only getting started.